I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And where are they now? The CEOs of the big three Detroit automakers have been driving hybrid cars to Washington, eating humble pie as they go, trying to repair their disastrous image as jet-setting, out-of-touch fat cats, and hoping to get $38 billion in bailout money from Congress tomorrow. The car industry crisis has also forced an emergency meeting of auto union leaders in Detroit today to decide what, if any, concessions union members should make to keep car companies afloat. For instance, will they have to give up the idea of a jobs bank that pays workers nearly full wages and benefits if they're laid off? As that meeting was underway, we spoke with Michael Ramsey, reporter for Bloomberg News. He's in Detroit covering the meeting, and we asked him about the jobs bank first. He described it as an agreement that when workers are laid off, companies will pay the difference between unemployment and 95% of their take-home pay. Now, this sounds incredible, so we asked Michael, why is this particularly important to auto workers?
Well, this is something that was negotiated about 20 years ago, and the union wanted to keep jobs in the United States, and they thought that by using this incentive, the companies wouldn't want to move jobs to other places because workers who were laid off would then, you know, they'd have to continue paying them.
Well, because in this industry, workers are laid off quite a bit, depending on production,
right.
And so it was
right.
Sort of an incentive to keep the workers.
Right, and that's the other, that's part two of it, is that, hey, you know, we're going to be pulled back in, you know, how can you expect us to keep working for the company and if we keep getting laid off for 2 weeks here, 3 weeks there, and don't get some sort of supplement to our income?
Well, the UAW defends the idea on their website because they say it's not as much a union thing as an industry thing. They say non-union companies like Toyota and Honda have the same system. In fact, mm-hmm. when they compare, they say Toyota pays much more workers when they're laid off than GM, Chrysler, and Ford put together. But, you know, is there a sense they might have to somehow review this?
Yeah, well, I think that there is definitely a sense that the union is going to have to make some kind of concession that is noticeable and understandable by the Congress people. And this has been called out as something that just seems, you know, hard for many of us to swallow, especially if you're in a job where you have very little security and you can be fired at any moment. And I think the union knows that. I just think it would be very difficult, I believe, based on what I've talked to since, you know, some of the union members to get that through, because
yeah.
the entire union membership has to agree to changes in the contract. It's not just the leaders. So, you know, all the workers have to approve it. So it would be a challenge.
Mike, what did the workers tell you as they went into the meetings today? I mean, do they really believe that their industry is on the brink, as the owners of the companies are saying?
Yes, I think that they understand the situation. There's a lot of frustration, and I think this is echoed through the country, that the automakers are being held to account to such a degree, while some of these large banks are being given quite generous amounts of money with no regulations and no stipulations, and just the idea that this is going to help the economy. I think there's a lot of frustration there, but they do understand the dire situation that the companies are in, and I think that they know that something must be done.
You know, the CEOs have been in the spotlight, but, you know, prior to that, American auto workers have been attacked for their large benefits packages. And, you know, they've defended that by saying, look, in other countries, the government pays for the health care of workers.
Yes. I think that one of the fundamental things that the UAW represents is they think, you know, there is nothing wrong with us getting good wages. There's nothing wrong with us establishing this high level of benefits because, you know, we do good work, and that the other workers should also have these kind of wages and benefits.
Did they speak to you at all about their CEOs who, you know, have made a big show of now driving hybrids to Washington as opposed to taking their private jets, and have said that they would work for $1 a year, even though their salaries last year were in the multi-millions, and pretty much across the board have been accused of not having the vision to see the direction that the U.S. auto industry should have gone in years ago? Have they spoken to you about their thoughts about their CEOs?
I think that there is and has been a long frustration that the union has been, you know, held up as the problem when, you know, management is largely responsible for strategic decisions. And there is definitely a frustration that with a level of executive compensation compared to the average workers, and that this is sort of a long time coming.
And what do they think about the dispute over whether or not the car company should have to go bankrupt in order to receive the government money? Supporters of the bankruptcy say that it will lead to reorganization and transparency. For instance, former Commerce Secretary Pete Peterson says bankruptcy is the only way to renegotiate union contracts. Now, the car companies say bankruptcy has a bad stigma. We don't want to do it that way. But there's already indication that you know, those in favor of bankruptcy say that's one way to get at the unions.
What people want to accomplish with bankruptcy seems to be only the labor contract. The reality is, I think the most auto workers understand that it would be extremely difficult to operate a company like this in bankruptcy. Also, the idea that you could easily renegotiate these contracts in bankruptcy is just absolutely false. There's a lot of evidence that renegotiating union contracts in bankruptcy is extremely difficult, and that union contracts take precedent over many other creditors in a bankruptcy process. It would be a fallacy to believe that it would be quick, easy, or successful to renegotiate a union contract in bankruptcy.
That's Michael Ramsey of Bloomberg News in Detroit covering the emergency meeting today of the United Auto Workers Union leaders. Michael, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, another industry trying to tighten its belt is healthcare. Massachusetts recently mandated that everyone purchase health insurance or receive it out of a pool of funds if they can't afford it. There have been problems with the system. For instance, critics say the costs are already exceeding projections. But overall, has it improved health? Dr. Tool Gawande joins us now with a snapshot of healthcare reform. He's a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston and author of Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance. He was also health policy advisor to President Clinton in 1992 and 93. Dr. Gawande, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
So everyone here pretty much insured where we are in Massachusetts. What's been the impact?
Nothing short of stunning. We, in the course of a year, went from a place that has somewhere around 12% uninsured to where it's dropping from under 5%. And the result in my own practice, I'm a cancer surgeon, is that uninsured patients from Massachusetts virtually disappeared. I haven't seen one in about a year. Being sick is just a different experience in the state in a way that's almost hard to describe, but it's totally different. The mandate that you have to buy some insurance at some level is an affront to our sense of personal liberty. What do you mean? You're telling me how I'm going to spend some of my money. Mm. On the other hand, I can tell you I had a patient who came in who is he's a self-employed carpenter. His wife is a school bus driver. They've had no insurance for over a decade. They were mandated to buy a health policy. They were subsidized. It kept it to about 6% of their income. I don't know exactly their income, but supposing it was $40,000 or something like that, that meant that they were making, you know, $200 or $300 in payments per month that they didn't have to make before, and that was huge to them. They were not happy about it, but having bought the insurance, they went ahead and got their first physical exams, and turned out to be more than a dozen years. And on the husband, they found a cancer in his neck that was still fortunately at a treatable stage, although it was starting to advance. The striking part of that conversation to me was he was incredibly grateful to have the coverage. He was still angry about being made to buy it. And I think that's our American dilemma. We want the freedom, but we also want the security. This is a guy who became extraordinarily sick, and we can't allow that person to just die because of it.
Well, sure. I think what I'm hearing from you is that being forced to buy coverage, as long as they had it, I'm going to use it, went in, found health problems that would have become much bigger and, again, much more, you know, heartbreaking, certainly, but more expensive down the road. So yeah. Forced purchase of insurance is making people healthier.
Yes, and I think it'll take some time to show that that's the case. But we know from Medicare, comparing 64-year-olds to 65-year-olds, it's the one group that, as they get older, gets healthier, because 64-year-olds are a group with a large number of uninsured, and suddenly you get to be 65, you get Medicare, and that group of people actually get healthier.
Well, Dr. Atul Gawande, how else would you cut costs? There's been a lot of talk about quality control. As of October, speaking of Medicare, will no longer pay hospitals to fix mistakes, you know, including leaving a sponge inside a patient or bed sores that presumably come because of lack of attention to a patient. Will that force them to take better care? What do you think is going to be the result of that?
Well, first of all, I think that move largely makes sense in the places where these are things that should just never happen, leaving a sponge in someone. And I think that making the incentives line up so that you don't make money by making a mistake. I mean, it's just a crazy incentive, even if hospitals aren't doing it on purpose. But the larger picture you get at is we spend 16% of all the money we make in America on our healthcare system. Almost everybody agrees we don't get real value, that kind of value for that money. So the puzzle is, do we know how to make that more efficient? And the answer is no. I think the fundamental cost problem, and it's a quality problem as well in our system, is that we are really, really disorganized. Here's a case in point. There's a researcher I wrote about in The New Yorker named Peter Pronovost at Johns Hopkins, and he came up with a simple checklist to use when ICU teams put IV lines in. These IV lines get infected about 5% of the time. And by following the checklist, which just says, oh, make sure you wash your hands, make sure you clean the site with soap, make sure you put a nice sterile dressing on, and so on. Following that, they reduced the infection rate in Michigan by more than two-thirds. They saved $200 million a year, and the worst hospital in Michigan got a lower infection rate than 90% of the hospitals in the United States. So now it's been 2 years since that's taken place. And how many states have been able to put that checklist in every hospital? One.
Well, why is that? Should government get involved in mandating some of this? And I ask that because President-elect Barack Obama has appointed a head of the Office of Management and Budget. This is Peter Orszag, who gave a PowerPoint here at Harvard about just this, and included in the PowerPoint was this Michigan hospital's 5-point checklist for doctors. I was wondering when I heard about that if this was an indication that someone in Washington is going to be mandating that all hospitals put this in.
If you had mandated that those hospitals put that checklist in, nothing would have happened.
Why?
You had most of those hospitals are small hospitals in small communities, many of them rural. They don't know how. How do you make your doctors do anything? How do you make the nurses follow these instructions? And how do you avoid just this being a regulatory requirement without being attentive to what patients really need? What they discovered was that all the hospitals needed was help. They would have a conference call every 2 weeks with someone from each hospital and say, how's it going with putting in the checklist? Tell me about this week whether you have enough soap in the ICUs so that you are cleaning all of the sites. And it turned out two-thirds of the units were out of the soap. 6 weeks later, every ICU had the soap. Then when they're on the conference calls, they said, well, the docs are refusing to use the checklist. And then someone else from another hospital would say, oh, here's what we did to help make sure the doctors followed along.
I'm going to stop you there, Dr. Gawande, because I can just hear people saying, what do you mean the doctors refuse to use the checklist? I mean, you know, if they're being told this will save lives, you know, it seems like such arrogance.
It does. And I've been there on that other side. You're deluged by so many of these that you just start saying no and you don't even think anymore.
That's Dr. Atul Gawande, Boston surgeon and author of Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, admitting that he also sometimes feels overwhelmed by directives. So what to do? We're going to have more with Dr. Gawande. Also later today, a break from serious news with seriously good sports books. But back in a minute with more from Dr. Atul Gawande, How to Fix the System Here and Now. Welcome back to our conversation with surgeon and author Atul Gawande about making the American healthcare system more efficient. Now, Dr. Gawande was just describing a checklist system that reduced infection rates by nearly 95% in a Michigan hospital, but it's not mandatory. It's only in place in one other hospital because overwhelmed doctors don't want to do it. No one knows how to run it. So, Dr. Gawande, what can be done?
The most important thing I think we can do is almost treat this the way we treat the economy. We start by saying, how are we doing in the economy? What's our economic productivity? What's unemployment like? And the equivalent in healthcare is, how many people are being harmed by healthcare and how many people are being helped? Can we measure the number of deaths, for example?
Find some indicators.
Key indicators. And then second, insist that we make it better. We did that in one part of medicine, and that's child delivery. We have focused for now half a century on making sure that fewer mothers die and fewer infants die. We follow maternal mortality and infant mortality, and we've cut those by well over 95%. And I think we can do the same thing. We could make our surgery safer and less costly. I think we could make it safer and more effective for treatment of many mental illnesses. And some of it involves really dumb stuff like making sure a checklist gets into place.
Barack Obama is talking about implementing technology. He says that will save tons of money. It sounds as if this is veering towards what you're talking about, organization. But there are also hospitals talking about more transparency. The hospital here, Beth Israel, made a lot of news by, you know, literally talking about the mistakes that had been made in the hospital, being more transparent about it. Is transparency part of the problem?
It is. We have to be willing to measure ourselves publicly. And transparency means being able to say, this year, did we do better for people with a depression or who had an operation than we did last year? And we honestly can't answer that question. We don't know. I mean, we almost need, people have called it a federal reserve board. We almost need a Fed at the top level to be able to say, here are the things that we who are doctors and hospitals are going to be transparent about, that we're going to be measured on our success over time, and then we're going to be as innovative as we possibly can be.
Well, it sounds as if you are talking about more government, you know, involvement. And again, we mentioned Peter Orszag, just appointed head of the Office of Management and Budget. He also says that people should know how much procedures cost. You know, we don't know what they cost. And he compares it to a study showing that people will drink more soup when they can't see the bottom of the bowl. In other words, you just keep going and you just keep doing. You don't know what it costs. You don't even think about it. And that leads me to another question. If people had more transparency, knew the success rate of hospitals, maybe they choose different hospitals, and the costs hospital to hospital, the range is unbelievable. We're reading UCLA Medical Center charges $40,000 more for end-of-life care than the Mayo Clinic.
A lot of the idea that people will shop around and then drive costs down has a very limited effect. For, you know, are people going to go die at the Mayo now because it's cheaper?
Well, you know, I was just thinking, I think if I had insurance, I would go to the more expensive place because right. I might equate that with better care.
And even if you didn't equate it with better care, you're not going to care too much about that cost factor. You just want to see which place seems the best to you. We just want to know, are we getting value for the money we're putting in the system? And we can't answer that question now. We have to be able to answer that. And that does take more government involvement with being able to measure what's going on. But we will make a huge mistake if we then also take a further step and say, well, the government has to run all of these systems. The trick is to offer real organizational support, which means measurement, some incentives, and also making sure that the way we pay people doesn't drive them to be both wasteful and error-ridden.
So let me be clear about what you're saying. Sort of a friendly, suggestion-driven, perhaps, federal agency as opposed to a regulatory agency?
The best way I can describe it is when we decided to take seriously the idea that the number one killer in the country for women was childbirth, and when we recognized the damage that infant mortality was doing, we implemented a system where we mandated that every hospital report their deaths. And it's transparent. It's been transparent for 50 or more years. Mm-hmm. We then put both state and federal governments on identifying the patterns of where these problems were. And we gave money to medicine to create new innovations. And so we came up with ultrasound before your child delivery.
And when you say we, you mean the federal government.
By we, I mean that the research money the federal government provided helped the medical establishment discover many of these really important things.
What can people do? What are consumers doing to drive up costs? Just a couple thoughts.
The most important thing I think that consumers can do is help push for a universal system. Because until we have everybody under the same umbrella, we mainly save on costs by passing it on in the form of insurance hikes, which leads people like employers to dump coverage from many employees or just not cover people who are unemployed. Second of all, I think the single most important thing that the individual person does when they see a doctor is want to have that extra test or believe that they need that antibiotic now. And I think what they have to understand is that you have actually better quality of care and safer care sometimes when you're willing to accept the idea that sometimes an antibiotic is not needed or an MRI might be the wrong thing to do the very first time you get a back pain. We also have to take away the idea that more equals better.
And that you maybe have to change the mind of the doctor, too, who's saying, I better do this because if I don't and I'm wrong, they sue me.
Yes. Part of it is that we are still, even when you're insured, we don't have a preventive system. We don't have something that, a system in place that says we have a serious obesity problem in the country that is a huge source of diabetes, probably the most expensive contributor to healthcare costs. And if we are as systematic about getting our obesity rates down as we were about putting a man on the moon, we could have dramatic effects on healthcare costs and make people's lives better.
Dr. Atul Gawande, he's a physician at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, a writer for the New Yorker magazine, author of Better, A Surgeon's Notes on Performance, and also was a health policy advisor for President Clinton. Dr. Gawande, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And by the way, tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll meet a woman in her living room in England who uses email to hook up medical specialists from around the world with desperate third world patients. That's tomorrow. News is next, Here and Now. As we mentioned at the top of the program, the big three car company CEOs made their trip to Washington in hybrids. But hybrids don't always get the best mileage. As the CEOs asked Congress for a combined $34 billion in public money, they've promised more electric cars and better fuel efficiency after decades of focusing on SUVs and increased power. So what is happening in the world of better fuel efficiency? Paul Eisenstein is an automotive journalist who runs the Detroit Bureau News Service. He also contributes to Motor Trend Magazine and The Economist. He joins us from WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Paul, let's go. Let's take a look at what the big three are doing, starting with GM, touting its hybrid, the Chevrolet Volt, set for sale in 2010. It will use a lithium-ion battery, but that's still in development, right?
Yeah, it is. Now, what the Volt is actually is something that some people call a plug-in hybrid. The technical term is extended-range electric vehicle. What it does is it uses a very high-density battery, and those pack a lot more energy into a smaller space. And that's pretty important if you're going to try to run mostly on electricity. What's unique about this concept, which, by the way, Ford and Chrysler have now said that they will come out with extended range vehicles as well, and so is Toyota. What's unique about these is that they have just enough battery to allow you to drive on a typical daily commute up to about 40 miles purely on battery power. You plug in at night or you plug in at work if you need a recharge. And then for longer drives, you're still able to go without doing these 8-hour recharges by automatically the car switching on its gasoline engine.
Right. Well, Ford doubled its hybrid fleet this year, but Ford is also getting ready to launch the Ford Fusion and Mercury Milan using new technology with lighter weight batteries, et cetera. Chrysler is probably having the toughest time. They want to roll out an electric vehicle by 2010, but they, you know, are dependent on trucks.
Yeah, unfortunately for Chrysler, it is a tough transition right now because they are, well, roughly 60% of their volume was in the light truck segment. Now, some people would like to see them go to diesel technology, which is what Mercedes is doing with some of their sport utility vehicles. The ML and the GL models are now using new clean diesel. Some other makers like BMW and VW getting heavily into diesel as well.
Let's talk about diesel engines. The Green Car Journal recently announced their Green Car of the Year, and it was the 2009 Volkswagen Jetta TDI with a diesel engine. Gets more than 40 miles per gallon on the highway, but we think of diesel as smelly, noisy, dirty trucks. So what's happening here?
Well, big thing that's happened. First of all you need to do is take a look at what's going on in Europe, where diesels account for roughly 50% of all new motor vehicles being sold. Huge transition. These are not the diesels that Americans remember, not those, as you said, smelly, noisy, rough riding. You had to wait for them to start in a cold day and so on. The new technology is clean, quick, fun to drive. I just had a Mercedes ML320 BlueTEC over the holiday, and I let people drive that thing and didn't tell them what they were driving. I asked people what they thought, and they said, wow, that's fun to drive.
Yeah.
I said, it's a diesel, and they would go, no, it's impossible. Diesels are really not something we like. And it is a huge transformation. In Europe, it's a hit. It's clean. The new diesels that are coming to the United States right now meet all 50 states' emission standards, and that's including the very tough emission standards from California. There's only one problem, and that's diesel prices.
Okay. Well, the big debate in Detroit, prices aside, is, you know, how to overcome the stigma that people have. But moving from that, what about the pure battery electric car?
All the automakers seem to be embracing the idea of going to electric vehicles. Nissan has said that it'll have one in the United States by 2010. Now we're hearing both Ford and Chrysler say that they're going to go to pure battery cars by then as well. It's a real question, and there's a lot of breakthroughs to be accomplished. We haven't seen the lithium-ion battery show that it can survive in the tough automotive environment. But there are many people, including Carlos Ghosn, the CEO of Nissan and Renault, who believes that by 2020, as much as 10% of the global new car market will be pure battery power.
But is electricity in a car actually better for the environment if, let's say, the electricity that you're getting to run it is from a coal-powered plant?
Well, that's the big issue that everybody's looking at. If you're using only the coal-fired plants that you see in the Northeast, it's going to be a problem. We are not going to do much to improve the air. The good thing is most people will charge up at night when you have a lot of this grid power available. But ultimately, if we go to true electric power as a nation, we should be looking at getting green sources of energy, or at least cleaner sources, whether it be natural gas or preferably wind, solar, wave, and some other forms of clean power.
Well, Paul Eisenstein, I mean, you're talking about solutions being in the long run, but in the short term, American car companies are failing. So what do you think? Can the big three turn around fast enough? You know, GM's head of electric cars, Bob Lutz, famously smashed them all with a wrecking ball. He said he didn't believe in global warming. Do these companies have the vision, the technology, the factories, the suppliers to catch up with other companies if they get a bailout?
I think that we have seen a dramatic change at the big three automakers. In fact, Bob Lutz, who you mentioned, was not exactly one favoring the concept of global warming. If anything, he contributed to it with his personal fighter jet that he liked to fly around on the weekends. But Lutz was the one that came up with the concept of this Chevy Volt, a vehicle that many people who will buy this in the future might never fire up the gasoline engine unless they have to go on the occasional long drive. So we're seeing Detroit making tremendous strides into the greener space. Are they caught up with the likes of a Toyota or Honda yet? Not necessarily, but they are adding great new vehicles very quickly. Not to sound like I'm hyping them, but I do think that they are making tremendous moves. Ford, for example, not only is moving into the electric space, they're also finding ways to improve the gasoline engine. They're about to launch technology that they call the EcoBoost. This is an engine that can give you, for example, V8 power out of a six-cylinder engine and get essentially the mileage of a six. It has an I4 version, a four-cylinder version, that basically performs like a six but gives you four-cylinder fuel economy.
So automakers are in the short term trying to figure out how to use gasoline better.
Yeah, gasoline is not going to vanish entirely. Even in Europe, where everybody does focus on fuel economy, gas still accounts for about half of the new vehicles.
That's automotive journalist Paul Eisenstein. He runs the Detroit Bureau News Service and contributes to Motor Trend magazine, The Economist. He's been speaking to us from WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Paul, thanks so much for looking into the car industry future with us.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been my pleasure to be with you.
And by the way, listeners can go to our website, here-now.org, to link to the Department of Energy website that compares cars with the highest miles per gallon. The Toyota Prius is, as it has been, in first place, 45 miles per gallon on the highway. Americans are buying them like crazy, although Toyota sales have dropped along with the big threes. Toyota is down 30%. And it could be because, as Paul says, the Prius is not perfect for everyone. For instance, if you have a big family or you have to carry heavy loads or herd cattle. He also says hybrids like the Prius may not be best for people who do a lot of highway driving. The hybrid can actually penalize you in mileage because you're lugging around the weight of batteries and motors, although the Prius at 45 miles per gallon on the highway sounds pretty good. You're listening to Here and Now. Baseball fans can now take their loyalty to the grave. in a casket with their team logo emblazoned on the outside, embroidered on the lining, and pillow on the inside. It's produced by a Michigan company that offers branded funeral products. A funeral home in Rockland, Massachusetts has already filled two orders for the caskets for, you'll forgive the pun, diehard Red Sox fans. Dan Biggins is co-director of the Magoon Biggins Funeral Home. And Dan, we're going to have a picture of the casket at our website, here-now.org, but describe it for us.
This casket is really, to be honest with you, very much like any other casket, with the exception of that it has the Red Sox logo, like as you said, emblazoned on the sides and on the top, as well as embroidered on the inside of the casket.
And now we understand that this company in Michigan that makes these sort of branded things had already made urns, right?
Yes, they have. They've been making urns for just over a year now.
What'd they look like?
The urns just look like probably a typical urn, with the exception that it has the base of it is shaped like home plate. It's in the team colors of red and blue for the Red Sox. And on the very top of the urn is a baseball with a glass cover on the top, which is removable, so that family members or friends, as part of the memorial services, can actually sign the ball or leave a message of endearment for their loved one on to go on the urn as well.
Well, now, this is quite something. It's part of, as we said, this idea of branded funeral products, the company's Eternal Images. Just what are some of the others that they make?
Well, Eternal Images makes right now Major League Baseball caskets for any of the Major League Baseball teams in the United States. So anybody who's a Yankee fan, God forbid, or a Baltimore Orioles fan or an Angels fan could get any one of those themed caskets as well.
Well, the company also uses other brands, the Vatican Library, the American Chemical.
And they also have Star Trek, as a matter of fact, as a themed urn, as a matter of fact, as well.
Star Trek urns, American Kennel Club. I mean, it's really quite something.
It really is. You know, to be honest with you, Robin, as well, themed caskets and personalization in caskets is really nothing new. It's actually been around for quite some time. Eternal Image was just the company with the ingenuity enough to try to secure trademarks for some of these copyright logos.
Well, and you, I'm reading in the Boston Globe, your funeral home specializes in trying to bring some sort of familiarity to a funeral. You've actually had an indoor campsite at one service for.
We certainly do. We really try to do what we call here at our funeral home celebrate life, which to us means that each person lived a very distinct and different and unique life, and we try to tell that story. You just referenced a campsite. We unfortunately had a young man that died. He had three or four young children, and one of their favorite things to do together was to camp in the summertime. As we were making arrangements with this particular family, one of the children suggested that they bring in Dad's canoe. And initially, the mom kind of laughed it off and said, of course you can't bring your canoe in, but we encouraged them actually to do that, and not only did they bring their canoe in, but they brought in a tent and a cooler and chairs, and these kids had the opportunity to set up a campsite just like they would have with their dad. And it really accomplished two things. It allowed them to kind of grieve in that way and to laugh and to cry as they did that. But also for all the mourners that came in, it really got to have them be able to intimately share with those kids some of those experiences that they had with their dad.
Well, you had another funeral procession that was led by the ice cream truck that belonged to the deceased, gave out popsicles to everybody. But what are the two people who have purchased these caskets? Now, these are people who are planning their funerals.
Mm-hmm.
What have they said about wanting a Red Sox casket?
Well, the way it actually happened with these two particular families that we met with, when we took them in to show them our selection of caskets, they just happened to see the Red Sox casket, and as soon as they saw it, they just thought it was really appropriate for their loved ones.
But why? I mean, what did they say? I mean, for people who are listening outside of the area.
Well, the first person who actually really wanted to have it was actually someone who their mom and dad met at Fenway Park back in the 30s, and the Red Sox were really kind of a fabric of their family's lives. They grew up and really enjoyed that together, and some of their favorite memories as a family was with the Red Sox during the summertime. And that, for them, was just a perfect way to be able to express that part of their dad's life, and that's how they wanted to celebrate his life.
Yeah. Just have to ask you one thing. I mean, you know, Red Sox fans waited decades for the World Series wins, and now I'm carrying this through, and there is going to be the image of something the Yankees would love, which is burying the Red Sox.
I'm sure they would love to see that, but in the realm of baseball, it hasn't happened in a while, fortunately for us Red Sox fans.
Dan Biggins of the Magoon Biggins Funeral Home in Rockland, Massachusetts, now offering Red Sox caskets bearing the team logo. Dan, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Well, thank you for having me, Robin, and have a wonderful day.
Well, that might not be to your sports fans' taste, so how about a great book? We'll have our best of list in a minute, here and now.
C.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Welcome back. What to get for the lover of sports literature this holiday season? Well, who better to ask than a guy who loves both sports and literature? Only a Game host, Bill Littlefield, is also in his spare time an author in his own right and a book reviewer for the Boston Globe. And he's here now with his picks for this year's Good Sports Reads. Bill, hello.
Hey, Robin.
And what, first of all, makes a good sports book for you?
Same thing that makes a good book in general. Something that is full of energy. One hopes for originality, although that isn't always available. You know, you want to learn something, you want to laugh, you want to have a good time with a book, you want to be sorry when it's over.
It has to be sort of Homeric, pull you through with an arc.
Well, Homeric is, yeah, I mean, we can shoot for that. We all fall short. But
well, let's start with football season because we're in it. One of the football books you have is by a familiar public radio voice, Stefan Fatsis.
Yes, indeed. Stefan wrote a book about being a kicker with the Broncos, sort of. He joined the Broncos in their exhibition season and in their training camp, and he sort of retrained himself to be a field goal kicker and wrote about what it was like to be among the giants of an NFL team. And it's a great book. It's fun. Stefan has a wonderful sense of humor, and I enjoyed it thoroughly. It was great.
This book is A Few Seconds of Panic. A 5'8", 170-pound, 43-year-old sports writer plays in the NFL. But as you say, he's not on the field, but he suits up.
Well, he's on the field during practice, yeah. And the NFL, of course, NFL stands for the No Fun League, and they won't let him actually suit up and play even in an exhibition game, I guess because they're worried that he will be crushed to dust and there will be litigation. No, he doesn't actually play, but he does everything but.
Okay. Well, by the way, we'll have all of the books at our website, here-now.org. But the next one is not amateurs playing, but professionals, a book that looks at how the Dallas Cowboys play. And in it we learn, one of them once played with a detached arm.
With the help of some good drugs and bad judgment, returned to the field after separating his shoulder.
This Emmett Smith.
Yes. There's a great deal more in this book than most people will want to know about the Dallas Cowboys, a great deal of time spent on off-the-field activity, much of it illicit.
This is Boys Will Be Boys, The Glory Days and Party Nights of the Dallas Cowboys Dynasty by Jeff Pearlman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're sleeping around, a player who sort of enjoys exposing himself?
Yes. Maybe? Oh, yes, it's all there.
Okay.
And more.
All right. Next, a book of short stories by Sports Illustrated reporter Gary Smith. These are collected from his magazine writing.
Right.
And you've said to us that he's an extraordinary writer. Why?
Well, he gets the opportunity to go long with what he writes. He gets the opportunity to spend a great deal of time with the people that he profiles. And the result is there's a certain depth, a lot of energy. He's very ambitious as a writer. He's absolutely tenacious in terms of trying to get the real story. Right. And so people that he writes about, you feel like you know all there is to know about Tiger Woods, for example, and then you read a Tiger Woods profile by Gary Smith and you say, whoa, I never realized
Didn't know that.
And it's quite extraordinary.
That's why the collection is called Going Deep, 20 Classic Sports Stories by Gary Smith. You have a sample?
Well, I have a piece from, a little bit from a piece that Gary wrote back in 1996 about Tiger Woods. Now, this comes from the days when Tiger's father was saying to the public in general and sports writers specifically, my son will do more for mankind than anyone who's ever lived. And he wasn't talking about golf. He was talking about really sort of, you know, improving the quality of life for the species. And Gary Smith is watching Tiger Woods at this particular time. He's in a press conference, and he says, now turn. Turn and look at us, the audience, standing in anticipation of something different, something pure. Quiet, just below the applause or within it, you can hear the grinding. That's the relentless chewing mechanism of fame, grinding to grind the purity and the promise to dust. Not the promise of talent, but the biggest promise, the father's promise, the one that stakes everything on the boy's not becoming separated from his own humanity and from all the humanity crowding around him. It's a fitting moment while he's up there at the head of the table with the audience at his feet to anoint Eldrick Tiger Woods, the rare athlete, to establish himself immediately as the dominant figure in his sport, as Sports Illustrated's 1996 Sportsman of the Year, and to pose a question, who will win, the machine or the youth who has just entered its maw?
Oh. Let's move to soccer and a book that you probably wish you'd gotten a contract to do. It's called, you love the sport, it's called Bloody Confused, A Clueless American Sports Writer Seeks Solace in English Soccer. The clueless one is Chuck Culpepper, and he decides that he hates the sports writing he's doing in the U.S. It's sort of shallow.
Yeah, Chuck Culpepper was a sports writer operating mostly out of Los Angeles, and his personal life took him to London, and he thought, well, as long as I'm going to London, I'll find something that will refresh my somewhat jaded sports tastes. And he ended up attaching himself to Portsmouth, a soccer team in England down in the south of Great Britain. He became a fan. And everything changed. And he found that it was quite glorious. And he met other fans, and he got all excited, and he got his enthusiasm back for sports. And it was quite an adventure.
Terrific book there. A book about the Little League. This is not the Little League I'm familiar with, where, God bless them, no one knows what they're doing. This is a town that produced, international winners.
Right. Toms River, New Jersey, produced teams that went all the way to the Little League World Series and won it. These kids play baseball so many hours a day that you wonder that they have time to fit in eating and sleeping.
And they play every day.
They play all the time, year-round. In the winter, they play indoors and work on their swings and in batting cages. And, some people are going to read this book and say, this is great, because this is a healthy activity for the kids. And some people are going to read it and say, holy cow, what happens when these kids stop playing?
Right. And how can any other kid live like that?
Right.
That book is called Six Good Innings, How One Small Town Became a Little League Factory. It's by Mark Creedler. So any parent, involved in Little League might be interested in that. All right, we want to go down memory lane for your last choice. It's April 1985, Caesar's Palace. The son of Brockton, Massachusetts' marvelous Marvin Hagler facing off against challenger Tommy Hearns. Some say perhaps the greatest boxing match of them all. Just three rounds and then... Bill, bloody awful to some, glorious to others. How does a writer get that on paper?
Well, the writer is George Kimball in this case, and he gets it on paper because he lived it. He was quite close to Hagler, to Marvin Hagler, while he was fighting. He knew the Petronellis who handled Hagler all those years out of Brockton. He knew all the fellas who were operating at that time. I hate boxing. I have no use for boxing. If I were the king of the forest, I would ban boxing. But boxing has produced some of the most marvelous writing of any sport.
And this up there?
This is up among them. George has really done a marvelous job of taking these four fighters who all fought at the same time and who really brought the very best out of each other.
The book is called Four Kings, Leonard, Hagler, Hearns, Duran, and the Last Great Era of Boxing. It's by George Kimball, a real insider in the boxing world, and it's highly recommended by Bill Littlefield. Bill Littlefield, again, host of NPR's weekly sports program, Only a Game. His essays, by the way, are collected in a book of the same title. And again, for his list of the best new sports books, go to our website, here-now.org. Bill, whose motto is, hey, bring along a good book in case a game goes bad. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.